Accession number 27083, Reel 36.
So Henry, the tape killed us at that very moment. I think both gentlemen's spirits were watching us at that moment. Can you say again who the two worst?
I say it with some regret. But the two, in my judgment, the two worst lecturers we had in my time, worse for in terms of arrogance and in terms of dullness, were Mountbatten and the First Sea Lord Caspar Drawn. They were very arrogant, they were very boring, and it did not go down at all well. And I don't think I was alone in those thoughts. Okay. Well then, at about...
Will you forgive my ignorance on here? Is Caspar John the son of Augustus?
Yes.
John? He is.
Yes. He's dead now, poor chap.
Yes, he will be.
He rose to, First Sea Lord, Admiral of the Fleet, and so forth. A remarkable man.
But dull.
Very clever, but not a good lecturer, certainly not at Latimer. Then I had started the course, I suppose, sometime in midsummer and finished in more or less midsummer, no, early spring. And at Christmas time, I was tipped off. By then we had 6 months' warning for promotion, and I got my 6 months' warning for captain for promotion, which put me as senior officer of the course. So at the end of it, I had to make a speech on behalf of the course, and I didn't know what to do about this. And I took as my theme the fact that each service, I don't know why this had happened, but each service, quite independently, had selected a bird as its logo. And the Navy had a pelican for its staff course. And so I dwelt on the theme, you know, the nursery rhyme, a strange bird, the pelican, its beak holds more than its belly can, and so forth. And then there was the Army had, now what did the Army have? I can't remember.
I don't know.
I've gone, let's switch off a second. The Army has an owl. And I recall that that little story which went around the naval staff, not I think the Army staff necessarily, in Whitehall, that the owl sat in a tree and it looked down its long nose. And it told the horses to face into the wind and the cows to back into the wind and the squirrels were to put their nuts. And after a bit, it occurred to the animals that the owl was attempting to teach them their business. And they tackled him about this. And the owl looked down his long nose again and said, "I only deal in policy." And finally, the Air Force, and their logo is a hawk. And the hawk is a pretty sharp cookie. It's got a long beak and it's got some fairly sharp talons. And you want to watch point. And I took the mickey out of the Air Force and that sort of thing. He went up very well. And with that, I left. And I went up to the Admiralty to find out about my next job. And the man dealing with captain's appointments, on behalf of the Naval Secretary, who was at Rear Admiral level, was in fact the same man who had been Director of the Gunnery Division when we'd had that gunnery conference at Whaley, and we'd discussed rangefinders and radar and so forth. Bertie Padfield, terribly nice man. And I remember his turning to me to discuss what I wanted to do in the future, because you did 9 years flat without the option as a captain. And he was going to note down any preference I had to do this or that.
Now, without the option means you've signed on for 9 years, you can't resign. Is that what that means?
That's right, yes. And then, at the end of your 9 years, you went up or out in those days.
And just to give me, can you give me your age now and the date, please? Just to give
I'm now talking of 1960...
Nineteen sixty-two.
And I would have been
39.
39. Yes, just that.
So before we go further, I'm sorry to stop you. Before we go further, is your once you reach captain, would I be correct in saying that you're starting to, if you like, to tread the lower rungs of the senior ranks? Would that first be right? And second, would it be normal for someone to reach the rank of captain at around the age of 39 or 40? That's question two. And question three is, did you have any inclination, any feeling at this stage that you might go a good distance in the Navy?
I was trying to take as say Aitim. I don't think you really regarded yourself as a particularly senior officer, and even in the run up to, there was a phase you had to go through to get to flag rank. I think it was when you got promoted to Rear Admiral, then you thought, I am really one of them, but not really as captain. In terms of whether you were going to go places or not, and this has varied over the years, but at that time, you really, if you were going to get anywhere, you needed to be a captain by 40. This is not to say that you wouldn't get anywhere if you didn't, but your chances were quite significantly less, because if you were good enough to make the flag list, then on the whole the leopard doesn't change its spots. You would have been good enough to have been promoted before that to captain. And on, I've forgotten what your last question was,
but I rather think that you've addressed the first, the second and third question in the in your first answer.
Have I?
Yes. Because yes.
Oh well, did you want to go further on? Well, you certainly wanted to go, because once you became a captain, if you were on the wet list,
yes,
if you were on the post list, if you were on the post list, then if you were on the dry list, of course you weren't in the running for command, and if the fact you weren't in the running for the flag list anyway. But if you were on the post list, then you would get one command, and if you were lucky or regarded as go ahead, you would get a second command. And because command is such a fascinating thing, you wanted to become a captain in order to get yet another C command, and when you got it, you wanted to go on as opposed to retiring early or any nonsense of that sort, because you at least had a chance of getting a second C command. So it all fell fairly naturally into place.
Thank you.
Well, when I called on this splendid, by then retired, captain, who asked me things about what I wanted to do, he also told me where I was going. He asked me if I... He said, I suppose you will want, in due course, to go as captain of Whale Island, HMS Excellent. And I shocked him by saying, well, no, not really. And he was staggered by this. And I said, well, not really, because what does the captain of Whale Island do? The commander looks after the domestics, pigs and the and that sort of thing. The training commander does, as the name implies, all the training. What does the captain do? Remarkably little, and so forth. So that upset him. And then he said, well now, where you're going next is out to the Far East, to Singapore. You'll be shore-based on the staff of the CNC Far East, as he then called himself, and you will hold the post of Chief Staff Officer, Plans and Operations. You will get a married quarter. You can be accompanied by your wife, and it's a very fine job, and it appealed to me a lot. I'll go into what the job meant and what the organization was a little later on. In fact, almost at once now. But that was that. So delighted, I went away. And I had a bit of leave, and we were all packed, ready to go. It meant flying out, of course. And at the last minute, we still hadn't got a house of our own, and we were staying with my mother down in Devonshire. And my wife Mary was taken ill. In fact, it was a miscarriage, but I wasn't to know it at the time. And so I had to go on alone, and I flew out from Stansted, and literally at the last minute I had to shuffle around with the luggage to extract her things and make sure that I had all of mine, because they'd been a bit mixed up before, and so on. So it was a bit of a thing. And I flew out, and I knew very little about the shore organization at Singapore. I had seen a bit of it as gunnery officer of Newcastle, of course, because we spent our time mainly based on Singapore or Hong Kong. But the Far East organization then consisted of what was called the British Defence Coordinating Committee, the BDCC, which was formed by the three service heads, together with a representative from the Foreign Office. And the longest in office of the service heads chaired the meetings. And that worked very well. And the longest in office was David Luth, who was later to become First Sea Lord. Below them was the Joint Planning Committee, the JPC, which was at Colonel, Naval Captain level. The chairman, again, was either the longest in office or the senior, depending on. And in this case, it was the senior, who was a full army colonel called Bill Smith, who was a very experienced staff officer. And then there was a group captain called Arthur Strudwick. And then there was me. And then again, there was a Foreign Office rep called Laurie Pumphrey, very fine man. It was a curious job in that it was a mix of single service. So my Chief Staff Officer Plans and Ops was single service Navy, based at the Naval Base. But my joint job was as the Naval member of the JPC, which met in Singapore. When Gerald Gladstone, who had been FO2, second in command, during part of my time in Newcastle, when he was CNC, he considered himself to be, I think he described himself as Britain's roving ambassador in the Far East. And so he liked to go around in the in one of the ships, or in Alert, which was the CNC's yacht out there, a small frigate. And he arranged it that if he left, everybody moved up in the bid by one notch. And so the chief of staff, who was a rear admiral, de facto became the naval commander, the CNC. The captain of the fleet, who was the senior captain, became, to an extent, the chief of staff. But more particularly, he had four captains of varying seniorities, one for intelligence, one for administration, one for technical, who was an engineer officer, and myself, plans and operations. And the latter, the plans and operations, encompassed, as its name implied, plans and operations, but it also covered signals, MET, all the weaponry, gunnery, torpedo, navigation, chart work, etc., etc. It was, as I used to feel, the waste paper basket into which anybody else, any of the other chief staff officers, who did not have it as their specific responsibility, it fell to P&O. And that was that. Fine. But it meant, with the CNC away for a good deal of the time, it meant that the buck stopped with you. And therefore, you had an enormous amount of work to get through, and you were fairly hard pushed. And I quickly found that it was necessary simply to do the job, and no question of not delegating, because you couldn't delegate. It had got up to you, and you had to deal with it. And I found it was necessary to work the whole of Saturday afternoon, and as often as not, Sunday mornings. You went to church if you could, and if you couldn't, you met up with your wife and small daughter and went off for a picnic on Sunday afternoon, and that was it. And you started at 8 in the morning, and you didn't get back terribly late, because practically every night of the week there was some function on, and you were expected to go to a good cross-section of those functions.
With your wife?
With your wife, yes.
So you had an armour?
We had an armour, a delightful girl called can't remember, it's gone, and a funny Chinese cook of very dubious age. The retirement age for lately enlisted personnel was, I think, 60 or something. We were never quite sure whether he was closest to 80 or 90. He was a dreadful old man. He smoked opium. He was quite a good cook, but he had latched on to some English names of dishes and things, or only half latched on to them. And so one of the earlier dinner parties we produced, and he had nodded as if he understood to Mary when she gave him a menu, and I can't remember what it was now, but it was I think it was patty as an entree, and he produced an enormous sort of Yorkshire pudding and a bowl of gravy. And we discovered later that my predecessor's wife had always, in order to get the message through, called this paste, and that meant something quite different to him. But there it was, we had quite fun with that. Now, not long after I got there and I'd settled in, there occurred what came to be known as the Brunei Revolt, which in turn led straight into Indonesian confrontation. And at the time it occurred, all the heads of service, which was not very clever, but all the heads of service were away in Hong Kong. And the Army Chief of Staff appointed a brigadier to take charge of things over in Borneo, only to find when his general, when his CNC got back, that his CNC didn't approve, and so the brigadier was replaced, and that meant a bit of a heave-ho, and so forth. And that sort of thing was rather inclined to go on. The David Luce, who was the chairman of the BDCC, the sailor, he was very skilled at it. The army commander was a general called Nigel Poet, and the air commander was a New Zealander, though RAF, called McGregor. And I can't remember the name of the Foreign Office chap, but he was a highly intelligent, nice chap, and very well up to the job. Nigel Poet loved the sound of his own voice. And when he was asked what he thought about some item on the agenda, he would talk about that and half a dozen other things ad nauseam. McGregor was a man of few words and almost zero cooperation, and he was difficult with a capital B. And David Lewis was adept. He would listen to all this lot. They'd all be saying something different, probably. And he would then quietly say, fine, I think we must get on to the next item. But that's all decided, so we will. And he then said what he reckoned was the right thing to do, which may or may not have borne any resemblance at all to anything that anybody else had said. And he was very, very shrewd at that. In the JPC, Bill Smith, the chairman, the soda, was good, but he was a classic, sort of the perfect, the handbook staff officer. And anybody that strayed from the path of staff work for a sentence did not go down well. The airman, Arthur Strudwick, was a funny little man who really rather liked the sound of his own voice. And I don't know what they thought about me. But I suffered, as I had done all my life, I suffered from car sickness given certain circumstances. And the one thing I could not do in a car was to read a paper, a book, or anything. If I did, quickly, I felt really very unwell. And there was, the island is 10, 15 miles across, and that was at the naval base. But the JPC meetings were held in Phoenix Park in Singapore. And quite often, an army messenger on a motorbike would come out at, say, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, a dispatch rider, with papers, up to and including top secret, which was not perhaps terribly clever to pass on a motorbike, but still, you know, it was supposedly a secure area. And this would say that in 1 hour's time, the JPC would meet to take such and such a paper or papers at very short notice. And this might be entirely unexpected. And I was faced with the problem that you either just read the headings and arrived fighting fit to do your thing without really knowing what the hell it was all about, or else you read the whole paper in the car on the way, because it took me half an hour to get there, if not 40 minutes, in which case you arrived white to the lips and shaking like a leaf and not fit for anything, but at least you supposedly knew what it was all about. And so I devised a scheme whereby I would get there very much on time, as often as not the first to arrive. And when the airman, Arthur Strudwick, arrived, I'd say good afternoon to him, and as soon as he settled down to his seat, I'd ask him some wet question. And he was very expert at all questions. And he would start to deliver the goods on the question, which enabled me to bury my head in the paper, having only just read the headings, and get away with it without actually feeling physically sick. I don't know if he ever found out. At about that time, though not much happened for a further year or so, was the question of setting up unified command. Now, I'm talking of the spring of 1962, and this would have been Mountbatten as Chief Defence Staff. And he was determined, come hell or high, to impose unified command first on the Far East and later on the Middle East. And various people, Frankie Festing, I think, the previous Chief of the General Staff, had been sent out to take soundings on how this would be organized and what the problems were and all that sort of thing. And the senior officer most vociferously opposed to the institution of unified command was David Luce, the chairman of the BDCC. And so Whitehall, thinking they were being frightfully clever, relieved him, brought him back home, gave him a couple of months' leave, and then sent him back out as the first unified commander. And he was relieved as the fleet commander by Desmond Ra, who had been flag officer flotilla's maid when I'd been driving Dunkirk. A very charming, very super man. But of course, Whitehall got it wrong, not for the first time, because no way was David Luce going to behave like a unified commander, which he didn't believe in. He just carried on as if he was still the chairman of the BDCC. And that was that. And he did this for 6 months. And at the end of that 6 months, he was relieved by Verrill Begg, a distinguished gunnery officer, a full admiral, a very good senior officer, went on to be First Sea Lord, and a very good statesman, so perfect for the job.
Yes.
And he, having been briefed to be a unified commander, proceeded to do so. And he came out and he went the rounds of the various headquarters informally just to see them. He'd been out there as second in command of the Far East Fleet, so he knew the general setup reasonably well. And he came out to the naval base, and that was fine. And he went across to the army lot in Phoenix Park, and he did. He really did it in order of service esteem, as it were, say it was Navy Army Air Force. And he did the Air Force last at Changi. And the air commander, this man McGregor, in a curious way, determined that the Air Force should be different. Issued orders that a guard was to be paraded and everybody was to wear their full dress uniform and all that sort of stuff. And Verrill Begg had explicitly said that he wished his initial visit to be informal, and he wished to meet in ordinary working rig, and he wished to meet as many people as possible. And somehow he got shown this signal and he blew his top and told off the air commander to get it right and so forth, which had the effect of setting them off on something of the wrong feet. But there it was. Well,
may I just interject with one very general question? What was the function of the Far East Fleet? Why did we have... This is, of course, immediately before Dennis Healey gets his claws into it and with the Wilson government and and the withdrawal from east of Suez and so on and so forth. But what was the function of the fleet there, given, I assume, please correct me if I'm wrong, that Brunei and Indonesia were not then and never had been part of the empire or the Commonwealth, and which were two minor conflicts we were involved in?
Well, they were...
I don't know. What was its function?
Borneo was, you see.
Was it?
Borneo was part of the empire. Brunei was independent. But independent in a neo-colonial way. I mean, it had its own sultan, the richest man in the world and all that.
Yes.
And so forth. It was the normal one of guarding the empire and deterring the baddies who were ill-intentioned towards it. That sort of thing. The